to make sure I'm turned up a little bit. All right, so we've had a little bit of time since our last meeting. We've, you know, suffered various interruptions of snow and holidays and all of that. But we will continue our study in Revelation. And you might remember that we have been really striving to kind of understand a number of the different ways that the book is understood. You could call them grids, you can call them frameworks, you can call them views, whatever you'd like. And so, does anybody remember the first one we studied?
Preterism.
Preterism, okay? Meaning that everything in Revelation has already happened. It's a past fulfillment, primarily focused on the fall of the temple in AD 70, okay? I've been actually, as I continue to work through all of these, it was interesting to find somebody who actually took all of the main events in the book of Revelation that we think about, the trumpets, the seals, the bowls, other occurrences, and then tied them directly to the fall of Jerusalem. In a way that I really hadn't had anybody lay out real clearly for me before. It was really interesting, and it really fits very nicely, too. And I want to encourage us to, as we look at these different views, and as we examine our own view, okay, whatever your view happens to be, and where my view is, that we ought to recognize the fact that the different perspectives that come to this generally do a fairly good job at making everything fit very nicely. Okay, so they managed to leave out some pieces that don't fit so nicely. So for example, as I listened to the preterist gentleman kind of lay through his various pieces, he talked about the two prophets. You remember in the book of Revelation, it talks about the two prophets that come and prophesy for so many days. I can't remember the exact number of days off the top of my head, but they prophesy. And many within, you know, futurist circles recognize and believe that's either Moses and Elijah or possibly Elijah and Enoch who would fulfill those roles. And even in the preterist telling, probably Moses and Elijah. But he sees that fulfillment as being when they came on the Mount of Transfiguration. And then he just kind of moved on. And I was like, well, wait a second. The book of Revelation gives this whole narrative about, you know, that they got killed. And then the people gave gifts to each other and they celebrated. And then they raised from the dead and everybody saw them. And I'm like, what about that? And nope, we're just not even going to talk. We don't. Just move right on, because the narrative that involved Moses and Elijah and the miracles that they did, the turning water to blood and fire from heaven, you know, that's all can be referenced to the works that they had done in the past. And then they came on the Mount of Transfiguration, and now they're gone. And so therefore that telling in the book of Revelation is fulfilled in that very simply. And if you just kind of skim right over the top, it works very nicely. But it's when you stop and dig in that you're suddenly like, but what do you do with all these other verses? And so it's, and I can tell you that there's some times when we look at the futurist point of view where you're going to kind of have the same response, and where the critics have those same responses. Well, what about these verses? And we're kind of like, oh, you know, just kind of set them aside. We're not sure. So be willing to have, you know, some criticism even for the viewpoint that you are willing to accept too, because ultimately, I think, you know, when we come to kind of a conclusion of these couple of lessons, and before then we actually open up the book and look through it, you're going to see that there's a lot of room for flexibility and understanding and grace to each other in all of this. So we talked about preterism. Do you remember what we studied next then? What came second?
Historicism,
okay? Historicism, a viewpoint that really came about in around 1300 with the turmoil in the Catholic Church. They were up to three popes at once for a while. They were being kidnapped, and there was battles and wars, and some of the popes were in France, and some were in Italy. And so writers at the time saw all of this change within the Catholic Church, and they said, there's the Antichrist. And then the Protestant Reformation happened after that, and the views just kind of caught fire, and that the Pope was always the Antichrist, and the Catholic Church was always Babylon the Great. And so there's all, historicism sets a template over these things, right? The Muslim hordes are the locusts in one of the judgments, and the fall of Rome is one of the trumpet judgments. The problem, of course, that we identified is that as history has gone on for another 800 years, everything that fit very nicely in the first telling 800 years ago has now had to move and be stretched out, and some things are still the same, but other things have changed. And so there's really no reference points for us to know, well, what's the actual occurrence that ties to this occurrence. And it gives us a vision of interpreting the scriptures by looking at current events and saying, well, this current event is that event. And what then came from the historicist perspective? What do we see develop from that? The postmillennial doctrine. Do you remember who in particular developed that? Anybody other than Anne? Waiting for my apple, Anne.
It's on the car.
Jonathan Edwards, right? Jonathan Edwards. And so the Puritans and many other reformers were historicists in nature. Okay? And Jonathan Edwards came forward with a postmillennial expansion of the historicist point of view. And it was the continued belief that things were getting better and that the church militant on earth was ushering in the kingdom of God, and that Christianity and the Bible, with Christ as our head, would be victorious over this sinful earth and usher in the kingdom. And so we saw that viewpoint then from Jonathan Edwards, and as things progressed, there was a lot of reason and hope within the, especially the Reformed Church, the Protestant Church, that was going to take place. Then what did we see the last couple of weeks? We studied a little bit of how then in the 1800s in America especially, but also in Britain, some of those viewpoints started to get stretched into some other ones. And so we looked a little bit on how the Seventh-day Adventists came to be, how they took those viewpoints, and what was her name? I've got it written down here somewhere on one of these pages. Mary Ellen Baker. Yeah. And how there was this, especially in the early 1800s, this rush to start setting dates. And we studied how there was this Christ is coming back in 1844. And one of the pastors had developed this whole theory around the book of Daniel, and Christ was returning back. And then they reset the date a little bit later, and then they reset the date, and then a third time they reset the date, and he didn't come back, and that was what they called the great disappointment. So they'd had two great awakenings, and then they had the great disappointment. And then Mary Ellen Baker, she had been a part of that. She claimed to have a vision, and that God told her in the vision that while the Adventists were correct about Christ coming back, that his coming back was a spiritual return at that point, and that there was going to be a period of probation, and then Christ would come back, and the great mark of the beast would be worship on Sunday, and that Christ would then come back at the end of that, and the Seventh-day Adventist would be his instrument for the future. Okay, and then from that movement, there sprang several others that eventually led to the Jehovah Witnesses, and at the same time period, we also had Joseph Smith and what he was doing. And as I said, I mean, how much of these things are satanically inspired visions? How much of them are simply a man trying to have a lot of power and do his own thing, get his own money, run a grift? I don't know. You know, and it's Much the same with Islam, right? Did Muhammad genuinely have a satanic visit? Or was he just writing a book to gain power over his enemies? You know, or both? So we looked at all of these different things and we looked at the history. And now we're going to look at some additional history. And I expect talking about this today is going to make some of you uncomfortable. Because it makes me uncomfortable. Okay, because to a large extent, most of us in this room, especially if you did not grow up Catholic, grew up with this, with dispensationalism, okay, and with these ideas and concepts. And generally speaking, as I grew up with it, and as I've listened to pastors talk about it over the years, we didn't talk a lot about where it came from and what its source is, okay, but primarily, it came from England and really started with a pastor there named John Nelson Darby, mid-1800s, no, a little bit earlier, so 20s, 30s is when he started, but he looked at his scriptures and felt that he was very convinced that you could divide the scriptures up into seven periods, and you see this significance, right? Hey, we're going to make seven is important to God, it's seven periods. All right, and can anybody name them for me? Do you know what the first one is?
Abrahamic?
Innocence.
Oh,
yeah. Does anybody know number two?
Noetic?
Sin. The fall.
Well, the fall is what triggers the next period. So the next period is triggered by the fall, and it's the era of conscience. Okay. So, and these often have a cataclysm that triggers them, right? So, you have the fall, and then what's the next cataclysm that happens in biblical history?
The law.
No.
Babylon.
The flood.
The flood.
The flood. That's the next cataclysm that triggers the next period, which is what? Man, I thought you were all dispensationalists here. I thought this was going to be, you know, a really basic review.
Government.
Government, yes, civil government. All right. Then what? What's the next cataclysm? The Tower of Babel, right? And so what era follows the Tower of Babel? Who comes next? Okay, the patriarchs. The patriarchs. Okay, and now the next one is real easy. This is the easy one.
Prophets.
The law.
The law. Okay, and then the period of the law goes on a long, long time, and then we get to what? Where we are now. What do we call this? The church age. And then seven?
Millennium.
The millennium. Okay? Millennial kingdom. All right. And right, there's cataclysms in between these. You know, you have the Tower of Babel. You have the captivity. You have the crucifixion. And you have Armageddon and the tribulation. Okay? And it's a nice layout, right? It's it's very, very extensively popular. And John Nelson Darby also did some other things that I think were really critical in the development of this and why this idea has been so strongly followed. So not only did he have the seven periods, but he also wrote in a role for Israel. And that the kingdom of Israel would be reestablished and that it was part of God's prophetic plan. And this was extensively different than Mary Ellen Baker, different than Joseph Smith, different than a lot of these other ones who, in their eschatological predictions, predicted that the blessings were going to fall on them and their people, and that they and their people were going to be God's instruments for the future. Okay. He came along and he said, we're going to be gone. God's going to take us out. The rapture's going to happen. We're going to be gone. And God's going to continue his program for history with the Jewish people. And that was, I think, to some extent, a really big shakeup versus what the others had predicted, where Joseph Smith said, hey, the Mormons are going to be in charge. God's going to use us. Or the Seventh-day Adventists are going to be in charge, or the Catholics, or the Lutherans, or the Puritans, who all kind of looked at, well, we're the people God's going to use. We're the ones who are right. God's going to come reward us, and we're going to move forward. And Darby comes along and says, that's not how it's going to be. That's not what the Bible says. And so this was a big deal. He laid out that there was going to be a seven-year tribulation period, more specifically than anybody else. And once again, he looked at it as the book of Daniel. You're familiar with the 70 weeks, okay? And he was the one who really matured this idea that 69 weeks had taken place and that the church age began and that the 70th week of Daniel is on hold until the future. And many of you are probably familiar with that idea, with that teaching, that there's this great intermission in God's plan, the church age, the age that was unseen by the prophets of old, the mystery that we're presently living in. The church age was not expected by anybody in the Old Testament. They simply saw the Messiah comes, the kingdom begins. The Messiah comes, he starts reigning. That was how, when you read Old Testament prophecy, it seems very clear that that was their vision of the future. And to have this mystery period of the church, Darby said, means there's this big pause. This is one of the chief areas of criticism amongst biblical scholars for him, because what they'll tell you is there's not really a biblical foundation for assuming that that pause is happening. There's an assumption being made there. I think that's a fair criticism, quite honestly. It's something you can deduce. It's something you can justify, but there isn't necessarily a biblical anchor point for making that assumption, for making that determination. And then Darby believed that Christ would return and that he would have a literal 1,000-year reign. So does most of this sound familiar to most of you, right? Okay. Now, Darby... just another man. And there's, you study his history, you study some of the work of his ministry. He's very evangelistic in nature, lots of revivalism and such things. There's room for criticism for Darby, okay? Not a perfect man. And this is part of where a lot of the criticism of dispensationalism and premillennialism and pre-tribulationism comes down on these viewpoints is on criticizing Darby himself, criticizing some of the practices, and did he have problems? Yeah. And so there's a lot of criticism that flows and demotes his layout as being illegitimate because of who he was. And we're going to talk some more about that, so I'm not going to gloss over that. We're going to come back to it. But I want to continue a little bit with history here. And I know we're laboring hard on history and all of this, and there is a purpose to my method here about why we're spending so much time talking about the history of all these different viewpoints. So I hope you'll stick with me. So after Darby... well, not after, but during his time, he started coming to America and bringing his viewpoints here to America. He made 5 trips to America between 1862 and 1877. So in 15 years, 5 visits, looking for places to speak, being called on to speak. And there were conferences and stuff. One of the most famous ones was the Niagara Conference. And there were Bible conferences that happened all over America, dating back even to... Revolutionary War times, the Methodist Church, they had their annual meetings. The Anglicans, they had their annual meetings. And these conferences grew out of those kind of annual meetings, similar to what we have today. I mean, I went with Pastor Andy to a 4-day conference at Alistair Begg's church. They call it the Pastors Conference. So, you know, these kind of conferences continue. And so John Nelson Darby would come, he would speak at these, and one of his most passionate guys who invited him to his church every time he was here was a guy named Brooks, James Brooks. And James Brooks pastored a church in St. Louis. And then there was a young man who had been a remarkable, really intelligent guy. When you read about his history, it's just, as a young man, extremely impressive. Served in the Civil War. After the Civil War, he went to St. Louis, and he impressed people there so much. He got his law degree. He went over to Kansas. He became a lawyer there, and quickly they promoted him to being chief prosecutor. He was the youngest prosecutor in the country. And then he did some bad things and got thrown out of office, and he kind of had to hide. He had to run out of Kansas in disgrace, and he ends up in St. Louis again and meets Mr. Brooks. The pastor there takes him under his wing, starts ministering to him. This is now the mid-1870s. Darby comes, speaks to the church. This guy finds Christ, and he studies with Brooks, and he becomes a minister. Any guesses to who he is?
Moody.
No, but good guess. Because Moody, mentioning Moody is a good thing, because Moody also was exposed to Nelson Darby at this point too, and heard his speaking, and Moody became a dispensationalist in the midst of all of this as well. But the person I'm speaking about,
Schofield.
Oh, wow.
All right. And what did Schofield go on to do?
Study Bible.
He wrote the Schofield Reference Bible. Okay. And so Schofield's Reference Bible, of course, holds and is built on all of these teachings and uses it as a framework for understanding the entirety of Scripture. And that Bible, that study Bible, was enormously popular. It's still popular.
That's right.
Okay? And so it was adopted by countless schools, and at the time, Moody and others began their Bible colleges and Bible schools, and this book was adopted as, basically, you had to have two things, a Bible and a Schofield Bible. And that was your textbooks. Okay? Schofield went on to be a pastor in Dallas, Texas. And a young man came there after Schofield, one of his students, and guess what he did? Anybody know?
Seminary.
Founded the Dallas Theological Seminary. Okay? And so you see these chains happen, right? And of course, American history, all the things that are going on. You got the Scopes Monkey Trial in the 20s. You've got Moody's ministry, followed by Billy Sunday's ministries, the evangelism going on. And these people then going into the ministries, going to Moody, going to Dallas, going to all these little Bible schools that taught this. And so you can see why dispensationalism is somewhat ubiquitous with American Protestantism and why it's such a big part of the background. And there was something about it that was particularly resonating with people. Remember how we talked about what Jonathan Edwards dealt with, right? So he comes in, and what do we see happening? The Great Awakening is happening, okay, all over. The darkness is melting away to the truth and the light of the gospel. And he develops a eschatological viewpoint that says that's what's going to keep happening. The gospel is marching forward. It's winning. It's victorious. Things are going to keep getting better. That was 1750, okay? Now we're talking 1850. Well, what's happening? War. Christ didn't come back when we thought he was. Civil war is going on. There was wars in Europe. And then you come into the early 20th century and you've got the Franco-Prussian War. You've got all these other problems happening, right? You had the whole movement in France in the early 1800s with Napoleon. And then Napoleon II, and Napoleon III, and just had all this turmoil and war. And so the vision that Jonathan Edwards was teaching was not playing out. And instead, we saw Christianity and those who believed in that being treated as idiots, especially when you got to the Scopes Monkey Trial. Okay? And so dispensationalism, which teaches a idea that things are getting worse and worse, that the future is pessimistic, that the church is not going to be victorious over this world and usher in the kingdom, resonated with people because it's what they saw going on around them. And when we talked about historicism, we talked about what was really kind of the final nail in the coffin for the optimistic view of the future. Two things, right? World War I, followed by World War II. They kind of sustained through World War I because they said, okay, this was it. This is the great war, the war to end all wars. Now it's going to be better. And then World War II came along, and it wasn't. And then everything after that, and the 20th century ends up being the most bloody century of all centuries that this world has experienced. So dispensationalism and the viewpoints that Darby taught and that his others followed up with really resonated with people, especially fundamental Christians, people who believe their Bibles, because it seems to fit the world that we're experiencing. So, like I said, I'm going to tie all of this history together here very soon. But I want you to not be unaware of where so much of our futurist perspective of the scriptures comes from and is tied to dispensationalism. And I will say to you that when it comes to dispensationalism, to me, it's a handy tool. It's an interesting reference point. But it's not Bible. Okay? The Scofield Reference Bible is not Bible. Okay? It's one or a group of people's considerations. It's a framework that they've laid over it to try to make sense of the Bible and to make sense of the future. I think it's, to some extent, just so overreaching and makes too many assumptions and too many guesses. And once again, it's similar to what the historicists are doing, where they, whether it was the guy in 1300 who laid out the book of Revelation and these things fit perfectly, or now they have to do 800 years and now suddenly it fits differently than it did before. When you take dispensations, you're doing some of that too, and you're forcing something to fit. He wanted to have seven dispensations. He wanted to have seven. He found seven. I had a colleague in Lansing who always said he loved long acronyms. So he would tell us this. He literally wrote this on his business cards. YAFWYLF, which means you always find what you're looking for. He's a good Christian man. I liked Mike a lot. We were good friends. Biblical theologians, especially around eschatology, have this problem too. Okay, you always find what you're looking for. You want to find seven dispensations? There's seven dispensations. Okay, I think some of them in particular are a very big stretch. Okay, you can see innocence. You can see conscience, okay? You know civil government came about, but is it really any different than conscience? I mean, it's just God laying out some different safeguards within humanity that changed because human life expectancies changed, all these other things changed after the flood. And then we have the law, okay? But not everybody was governed by the law, okay? So, I mean, to me, you can see some very clear things in history. What are they? What are the most clear things in history? The fall? The crucifixion, the resurrection, and the return of Christ. You know, so I could divide up and make seven things work for you all too, right? This is similar to what we talked about with numerology a few weeks ago. Do you remember talking about numerology, right? And how you can make Nero's name equal 666. You could also make Justin Trudeau's father's name equal 666, Ronald Reagan's name, and if you know, is it their full name? Is it their first name? Is it adding the word president to the front end? Is it adding the abbreviation of president? Is it adding their middle initial? You can do whatever you want if you want to make it fit when it comes to revelation, eschatology, numerology. It's just like I said with the preterist view, right? He's taking, oh, Moses and Elijah showed up on the Mount of Transfiguration, thus the two prophets, story's over. We're not going to talk any deeper about it. It's just, it fits. And we have to be careful. I want to be careful with all of you to not make things just fit because we want them to. Okay? And so dispensationalism, I think, is a very handy reference tool. I think it's handy to understand history of the scripture. But I don't think that God is actually doing anything different. And that's what Darby generally was trying to teach. And one of the really kind of ugly things that he taught within this view is that the Bible is not for everybody all the time. He taught that certain sections of the Bible were for the Jews, certain sections of the Bible were for the church, certain sections of the Bible were for the future, and certain sections were only for the past. And I don't agree with that. But that's a large extent why certain churches for periods of time throughout the 20th century didn't teach the Old Testament. Because dispensationalism said that's not for us. That's not the church age. The church age is reading the letters of Paul. That's it. We don't even need to read the Gospels. And Darby taught that the Sermon on the Mount was not for us. That was for the Jews. So he's just a man. Okay? Martin Luther, just a man, not perfect. Okay? And this is kind of part of what I want us to emphasize is that the criticisms that he receives may be very fair. Okay? There's good reasons to criticize Martin Luther and John Calvin and probably Billy Graham and probably John MacArthur, right? There's reasons to criticize me. Okay? However, in saying that, I think one of the unfair things that has come about then, as we look at the futurist point of view, which is to a large extent in our current world, tied up with dispensationalism. It doesn't have to be. There were futurists before dispensationalism as well, but there's a lot of connectivity here. There's certain teachings from Darby that I agree with, okay? My point is that the criticism he is taking right now from a lot of Bible teachers, Bible colleges, etc., is to say, well, look at his life and look how new he is and look at some of these other weird things that he did. Therefore, everything is off limits. And they'll throw that criticism on Darby, but they won't throw that criticism on Martin Luther. And they won't throw that criticism on Jonathan Edwards. They won't throw it on somebody else, right? And that's the part I want us to be a little bit, to step back from for a second, is to recognize that all this history I've been teaching you, right? Whether it's a historicist viewpoint or preterism, dispensationalism, that these viewpoints have all come about as the church grows and ages and is trying to deal with what is going to happen in the future. And different views have been thrown out there, and some of them continue to, it's like pieces of them persist because they seem to be broadly acceptable. Other pieces have fallen off as unacceptable to everybody. And then others, things have kind of been mixed in, and some stay with one, some stay with the other. Right now we have a movement in the Christian church that's very connected to the Puritans. If the Puritans believed it, we should believe it. Is that how simple our Bible translation should be? I mean, if Jonathan Edwards was always right, or John Calvin was always right, or Martin Luther was always right, okay? And so, even though this is a newer, some of these things are newer, the idea of the rapture, etc., is a newer idea, doesn't necessarily disqualify it any more than at the time Jonathan Edwards' view of postmillennialism was new as well. And so eschatology in particular is developing. And on top of that, other views are developing. What's one of the biggest doctrinal controversies in the 2,000 year history of the church?
Christ coming.
No.
The time of the rapture.
No. Think older, further back, bigger.
Azusa Street.
What is a doctrine that is just for us so paramount to everything and yet is so inconceivable and is divisive between the real church and those who aren't?
Trinity?
The Trinity. Okay? The Trinity. Do you know that the word Trinity is not found in the Bible anywhere? Okay? And yet, this doctrine is something that we believe in, that's well established, that has been debated. They had church councils on the nature of Christ and the nature of the Trinity. They wrote whole creeds to verify what the church believed about these things. And so there's many other doctrines of the church: salvation, redemption, atonement, justification, that have also been controversy and have matured and developed over time. Okay, it's not a new thing for the church to have these internal debates and struggles. Eschatology, I see, is just another one of those that continues to go through a maturation process and understanding, but it's also kind of the murkiest and the hardest one, right? And it's tied up in our desires for the future. It's tied up in our hopes and our... And sometimes it's tied up in our politics, and sometimes it's tied up in, well, we need our church to be right and that one to be wrong. Okay? And so, as we continue to, we've got one more framework to look at when it comes to how to understand Revelation, and then we're going to move forward finally and kind of out of the history. But I want us to just really be thinking about how much of a role history plays in these things, how much church history has played into this, but also just how eschatology is going through some of the same process and development of better understanding that so many other church doctrines have too, and some of the same struggles that we have. Baptism, what does it mean? Is there power in it? Is it a symbol? Is there mystery tied up in it? Same with communion, right? You have one extreme, transubstantiation. You have another that says we shouldn't do it at all. And with all points in the middle. And eschatology has a lot of that same thing going on. And what I've found as I've been studying these and preparing these lessons for you is, and this really frustrates me, is that there is a sense of arrogance and condescension,
yes,
amongst everybody's point of view in eschatology. We're right, they're wrong. We follow the Bible, they don't. We're literal, they're not. And I mean, some pastors and preachers that I really like, that I really have always enjoyed their Bible laying out, and then they get to this, and they're just like, those other guys, you know, I don't know what's wrong with them. They follow this crazy Darby guy, you know, and it's strange, and it's frustrating, and I think we can have a lot more grace for each other. Okay, I want to have grace. The preterists have biblical proof texts that they use. The postmillennials and the amillennialists, they have biblical texts that they depend on. They have criticisms of the futurist point of view, some of which are fair criticisms, okay? And I want to be open and honest with you and be willing to discuss those criticisms as weak points in my argument. Okay, I don't want to come across to any of you as teaching you to condescend on those who have different points of view. So I'm trying to be very careful about that. I'm trying to lay out a history so you really understand where these views came from, how they developed, because that development, I think, provides us with some better understanding It comes with some room for criticism, but it also shows us that all viewpoints have a history. They all had a history somehow, and they all got to where they're at somehow or other. Whether it's about eschatology or salvation or the Trinity, especially eschatology, what's the reason to be dismissive of others, right? I mean, this isn't, it's not a good reason for separation from one another, because if you still believe who Jesus is, that he's God, that salvation comes through him, through this atoning sacrifice, that he's coming again. I mean, these are the main points that should bind us together. The ideas of, is there going to be a real kingdom or a figurative kingdom? Is it, was Revelation fulfilled in AD 70 or not? There's just not really as much cause to divide over that, right? It's kind of like arguing, you know, is Brett Favre better than Aaron Rodgers? Okay. And that might be too much of a diminution of that of this, but, you know, Packer fans have these discussions, but they're still Packer fans, right? And the church should be able to have these kind of discussions and still be the church. And we see good examples of this with, I think, just one of the most gentle souls I've experienced is R.C. Sproul, who's a preterist, a partial preterist, and yet was very good friends with John MacArthur. And so there's room for these disagreements and to still have fellowship together. Any thoughts? Any ideas you want to lay out there? Criticism? Yeah.
So I'm thinking that some of the differences could fall into the category of assumptions based on the facts in the Bible. And aren't we kind of warned about adding into what's there?
Yes, we are.
And it's so, isn't it kind of a little bit of a maybe a trap? Or a little bit of a be careful of this kind of thing?
We should always be careful about adding anything to the scriptures that isn't there. Dispensationalism doesn't necessarily add words to this text, but adds a framework that's not necessarily prescribed. It makes assumptions. And in my opinion, some bad ones. Other thoughts? Anybody? I hope. Like I said, I know a lot of you come from this dispensational viewpoint, okay? Or you know, you see how your futurist viewpoint has stemmed from this viewpoint, and it might be a little uncomfortable hearing that. It's uncomfortable for me. It's like, this is where I'm at. Do I want to hold on to this? Am I wrong? Okay, we're going to talk about that. Dad?
Yeah, you always have to keep in mind that all of these different viewpoints that they're. There's a good bit of the reason of man involved in each one.
Exactly.
And man has a tendency to believe his own reasoning and to slander those that don't agree with him. And whether it's in the study of Christianity or whether it's involvement in politics, whatever it is, this human nature is always in the middle of it. So we need to, I think you're doing well to look at them all and with tolerance for each viewpoint. But at some point you have to decide what you really settle on.
And I made it clear to the group, I'm a futurist, and I believe that's a defensible position. I believe it's a worthy position, okay? And so, I mean, we're going to get there. But it's important to recognize a lot of what futurists accept as true has come forward from this man and what he laid out, some of which I don't think is defensible. But a lot of our views and church things that we accept come from other men who reasoned, and reasoned correctly on many things, but obviously reasoned incorrectly on others, whether it's Martin Luther or others.
We see church age as moving to the millennium, and they each group leaves out the scripture that they can't explain, and so they make this assumption, leaving out what Jesus has said about the poor you always have with you, and will there be wars and rumors of wars right up to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And so how are we doing away with war when we know that Christ says we have war up to the very end?
Yeah. And no man knows the hour.
Right.
And no man knows the hour. So, I mean, we have a lot to talk about yet. We're going to talk more about it. But this was the scariest lesson for me. I wasn't sure if you would throw things at me today to start kind of picking at dispensationalism a little bit and say, you know, let's not just blindly accept what we've heard and what we grew up with. Let's offer some good criticism of that as well. So I hope you'll come back next week. So anyway, let's pray. Dear Father, thank you so much.